and I can feel her presence looking over me at all times. I can't feel that with my original family. Not that strongly, anyway. Because of my faith, I believe they are in heaven, right alongside Helen. But the bond fades a little more every year. Probably because I'd spent so long blocking their memories out. My eyes don't water up with grief anymore over losing Helen, my adoptive mom. We had a good full life together, and she was in a lot of pain from the cancer at the end. It was a blessing when she slipped away, clutching my hand in hers. But God, I miss her so much. The woman who is personally responsible for all I am today. The woman who actually saved my life, then built it into something that was far greater than I ever could have imagined based on where I'd come from. In the distance from the direction of the main ranch house, the dinner bell clangs. Smiling, I push up to my feet. Raul loves ringing that damn thing, even though he could have just as easily sent me a text to tell me to come on in and eat. Okay, Nene. His lordship is calling for my presence at the supper table, I say, not the least bit abashed by talking to her grave. Sorry I can't stay longer, but really, not much more to report. I'll come back in a few days. I get no response, beside a slight breeze from the west. Is it her answering me? Who knows? But I like to think so. Love you, I say, before turning and heading to the gator.
Wash your hands, Raul orders me as soon as I walk into the kitchen. He's stirring taco meat in a pan, and I can smell fresh corn shells roasting in the oven. On the counter, several spice bottles are lined up, because Raul would rather die than use prepackaged stuff. I head to the sink and give my hands a good scrub, my stomach rumbling with hunger. For lunch, I had a package of peanut butter and cheese crackers, and nothing for breakfast prior to that. I wouldn't be having this meal of tacos and what looks like charro beans in a pot on the stove if it weren't for Raul. I'm terrible at cooking, and I'm a sucker for anything that comes in a convenient package. In addition to managing the ranch, Raul has taken it upon himself to get at least one home-cooked meal in me per day if he can manage it. At first, I'd thought to complain about it, because he does so much for so little anyway. But then I realized, Raul has an empty home. His wife died years ago, and all his kids have moved away. If he doesn't eat with me, he would be alone in one of the small staff cabins on the land. That's a sadness I don't want to bear.
Grab us a few beers, he says as he turns the stove off and grabs a pot holder.
I do as he asks because an ice-cold beer after a long day of work is always the best-tasting kind. Raul pulls the hot corn shells out of the oven, placing them on the Formica counter. After I open the beers and put them on the tiny kitchen table, I move to accept a plate from Raul that he'd pulled out of the cupboard. I load up three tacos with the meat, beans, and freshly grated cheddar Raul has in a bowl. He never bothers with lettuce and tomato, but I spoon on some green tomatillo sauce he made. My mouth waters slightly in anticipation. Raul had worked this ranch long before I bought it at auction with the help of my mother. It was here that I had my very first riding lessons from none other than Raul himself when I was 12. He was a gentle and patient teacher, and he curated a love for horses within me. It was a special outlet for me, where I could be free from my horrible memories of the time before Helen rescued me. When I bought the ranch, it was only done with the promise by Raul that he would stay on and help me with my vision, to use horses as a means of healing. Not like he had anywhere to go. He's 67, and most employers think that's too old. But frankly, I couldn't do any of this without him. At the table, the only sound is the crunch of tacos and the occasional slurp of beer. Eventually, Raul asks,
"What's the deal with the new client?"
He knows I can't tell him any details about my counseling with Tacker, but that hasn't even begun yet. I shrug. He's not talking yet,
so I put him to work in the stalls.
Raoul chuckles.
That usually gets their gums flapping.
He noticed my accent, I say as I pick up my beer bottle.
You must have been nervous,
he says with a sage nod. He knows me that well. Well, his counseling is mandatory, and I have to report back to his employer. I expect our next meeting will be more productive.
He's going to be difficult for you,
Raoul murmurs, and I can hear the worry in his voice. He always worries for me, has since the day I met him almost 20 years ago, when I took my first writing lesson from him.
You might need to share a bit of yourself with him to get him to open up.
Wouldn't be the first time I've had to do that, I reply as I pick up my beer. I hold it up for a moment, pondering. I wonder what the best approach to take with him is. You were in the barn. You heard how averse he is to anything that promises him even a sliver of hope.
Just heed him with your rays of sunshine, Nora. You have a special talent in making people believe in the best.
I snort, because he's very much exaggerating. I don't have special powers or talent. I'm a good listener, though. And through my education and training, I know how to give the proper kind of guidance. I'll Google him tonight to get the basic background on him. Maybe that will give me some ideas on how to handle our next session on Thursday. But for now, there are more important things to discuss at dinner. I take a sip of my beer, put the bottle back down, and then lean forward. So, tonight's bingo at the community center. I heard Tilly's grandson say she was going, I tease.
So?
Raoul replies gruffly, his focus on his tacos suddenly super intense. So, you should go sit with her. She's totally sweet on you.
Si eres buca,
he grumbles, a gentle rebuke for my ribbing. But his cheeks are turning slightly red under the dark tan he has.
I'm too old to be worrying about who's sweet on me and who's not.
Mary Beth Henson is most definitely not sweet on you, I say with a snort.
Good, he replies with a smirk. She's a Heridan.
Mary Beth helps me with the ranch house, cleaning it for me every few weeks. I'm so busy that mopping floors and dusting furniture are the lowest activities on my priority list. So I broke down and hired her to help out. While Raoul lives in guest quarters on the ranch, he freely moves in and out of the main house, often taking most meals with me. For some reason, he and Mary Beth don't get along. It's just, I hedge a little, not willing to give up on Tilly. I don't want you to be lonely. You pour your heart and soul into this ranch and into me.
Exactly,
he says, cutting me off.
I have you.
Raoul's wife died 9 years ago. She was a sweet woman who doted on him. They have 2 children and 5 grandchildren, but they all migrated and moved east, so he doesn't see them a lot. While I love him like a father and a best friend, I know my offerings to him have their own shortcomings. I want him to have someone in his life who will focus on him 100%. Tilly would do that, if he'd let her. I love you, I say gently. I just want you to be happy.
You want everyone to be happy, Nora. You want everyone to find the same peace you have. And I can only offer you 2 truths about that. First, I'm happy just as I am, and I don't lack for anything. And second, not everyone has the ability to find peace. Some prefer to stay in the dark.
He's talking about Tacker now. Another slight warning that I've got my hands full with this client.
Chapter 6. Tacker. As I pace around my apartment, I'm not quite sure what to do with myself. I got my workout in, which included a 7-mile run this morning, After I made a healthy breakfast, I went grocery shopping, adding more healthy items to my cupboards and refrigerator. Admittedly, over the last 2 weeks since the crash, I haven't been following the best of regimens when it comes to food and exercise. I think in my mind I'd given up believing the Vengeance would want me. I'd started my slow descent into losing my six-pack to a potbelly. Since meeting with management on Monday and accepting their terms, I've kicked it at the gym, rid my apartment of the Cheetos and Cocoa Puffs I'd been living on, actually went and got a haircut. I'm slowly making my way back, and now all I have to accomplish is the dreaded talk tomorrow with Nora that will supposedly start off my counseling sessions. The terms of my place on the team are clear. Talk my shit out with a counselor and fix my shit so it doesn't negatively impact the team. There is no in-between, and it's really a no-brainer. It's not like I have to really think this through. If I had a best friend, I wouldn't be calling him or her up to ask their advice on what I should do. If I had parents I was close to, it's not a situation where their wisdom and love would give me guidance. But I have neither a best friend nor parents to turn to, so it's kind of moot. I make my way into the kitchen, but there's nothing to do. The counters are spotless, the dishes are done, and I even mopped the floor 2 days ago. I suppose I could go buy a table and chairs to go in here, maybe even a couch and a coffee table for the living room. My furniture consists of a recliner and lamp there and an air mattress in the bedroom. I've lived such a minimal existence since MJ died. I didn't really need anything else. Mine and MJ's house in Dallas was sold fully furnished. I'd only kept my clothes and a few things from the kitchen to cook with. I didn't want anything to remind me of the home I'd shared with MJ. But no one comes over, with the exception of Dax and Bishop storming my apartment the day before yesterday, when Bishop had told me to get my head out of my ass. I wish his words meant something to me, but they don't. Not really. Okay, maybe a little bit. I mean, I live for hockey. It's probably the only thing keeping me alive, and when I commit to my team, I commit to them all. I want them to succeed, and in that sense, I care about them deeply. So yeah, it fucking hurts a bit to know I've let them down. So maybe it does mean something worthwhile that they both took the time to come to see me after it was announced I'd be returning to the team. A knock on my door startles me badly, mainly because I'd been steeped in thoughts of visitors to my apartment and no one ever comes over. The fact I've got someone here to see me is shocking, but I'm also bored shitless, so I can't say it bothers me. I move out of the kitchen into my small, dumpy living room and then open the door without bothering to look through the peephole. I can only stare at the blonde man standing on my threshold in complete and utter fucking shock. "Hey, man," he says with a grin, his green eyes flashing in the sunlight and crinkled at the edges. Aaron Wilde. Considered by some to be the wildest man in the league, both on and off the ice. It's why most people just call him by his last name, Wild, and why whenever we used to go out, he'd be swarmed by all the women. But I never called him Wild, only Aaron. He's the man who, at one time, I considered my best friend when we both played for the Dallas Mustangs. Of course, that relationship ended when MJ died. I cut him out like I did everyone else. "Going to invite me in?" he asks, and it startles me. "Yeah," I mutter, taking a step back. "Sorry, just caught me off guard." Aaron brushes past me, scanning my dump of an apartment. As I close the door, he says, "What a shithole." "It works for me," I reply, not in any way defending my choices, just being matter of fact. He turns to face me, pushing his hands in his pockets. I don't know whether to hug you, shake your hand, or punch you in the face. Take your pick, I say flatly, but I move into the kitchen to pull a bottle of water out of the fridge to offer him. He follows me in there, accepts the bottle, and just stares. What are you doing here? I ask, leaning a hip against my counter and crossing my arms over my chest. You weren't at the team meeting this morning, but I figured someone would have texted you at the least, he replies with a smile. I got traded here. No shit, I murmur, and there's no hiding the happy tone in my voice that news brings. The trade deadline is at the end of next week, and I knew we'd be picking up some new blood. Aaron, in addition to being my best friend, was one of the most talented defensemen in the league. He'll be an amazing addition to the Vengeance. Since we're making a legit run for the cup this year, it's a great move on management's part. Let's go get a beer and catch up, he suggests. I shake my head, not interested in catching up because that would involve telling him how shitty my life has been the last 15 months. But I can't even say that. Instead, I fall back on a better excuse. Not allowed to drink. Aaron's eyes dull a bit, then drop down to the cast on my left wrist. Got anything to do with that? It's no secret, my accident. It was in the news. Veteran hockey star in drunk driving accident. That's what the headline said. It's also no secret within the league that I was temporarily suspended from the team because of it. Aaron has no clue how deep the shit I was in was because he doesn't know I drove my truck into that barricade intentionally. Let's go grab some lunch, I suggest instead. I suppose we need to talk, seeing as he's now firmly back in my life as a teammate. He's been worried about me. We haven't talked in several months, mainly because I kept blowing him off after MJ died. When I got traded to Arizona, there was almost a relief on my part to have distance from him, so I wouldn't have to look at his worried expression anymore. I take Aaron to the Sneaky Sawaro, a large Tex-Mex restaurant and beer garden boasting over 127 varieties of beer on tap. While I can't drink, and don't want to anyway, Aaron will appreciate not only the beer, but also the hot waitresses in denim cut-off shorts, bare bellies, and big tits. He's a certified player when it comes to women, and he might as well be introduced to the Sneaky Sawaro, as it's where the Vengeance usually hangs out after a game. We get settled into a booth on the second floor, and Aaron curls his big hand around a mug of draft beer. I sip on a glass of ice water as we peruse the menus, far longer than we need. It's an avoidance on my part for sure, because the minute I'm done trying to decide what I want to eat, Aaron is going to want to talk. So, I know some of what's going on with you, Aaron says out of the blue, and I let my eyes rise over the edge of the menu. But the news is sort of vague on details. Going to fill me in? Sighing, I set the menu on the table. Why I bothered to look, I have no clue. I always get the steak fajitas. Slouching into the booth, I clasp both hands on the table and give a slight shrug. You can probably figure it out. Haven't been doing all that great here. He knows I mean on a personal level because I've been killing it out on the ice. Drinking and driving? He asks with a cocked eyebrow. That's not your style. You were never a big drinker. Yeah, well, have your fiancé die while you watch, and that might change things, I mutter. I wince as soon as the words come out, and there's no stopping the backward flinch from Aaron as they strike. I'm sorry, I say. It's the first time I've apologized for being an asshole since, well, I became an asshole. I have instant regret for doing that to him. Aaron raises a hand, waving me off. What are you doing to move on? It's a bold question. Most people who would ask, I'd tell them to go fuck themselves for being nosy bastards. But this is Aaron, and although I've successfully pushed him away over the last year, I have Bishop's words ringing in my ears. Yes, he'd told me to get my head out of my ass, but he'd said something else I'd been thinking about. You see, I want to win the fucking cup. In order to do that, everybody on this team has to be playing at their maximum. You have to give forth every effort, and you have to rely on your teammates to do the same. That involves a certain amount of trust. And if you can't open yourself up to the men on this team who would probably lay down their lives for you if asked, it's not going to fucking work. That had struck a chord within me, because what ultimately led me to the decision to stick with the team, even if I had to get the counseling I was so loath to undergo, was that I wanted that camaraderie of the team back. It was the one thing that gave me self-worth while I continued to fuck up all the other aspects of my life. I'm starting counseling tomorrow, I offer. He blinks in surprise, his lips curling in approval. It's mandated by the team, so I have to do it. Good, he says firmly. You should have done that from the damn start. He's the only one I'd let talk to me that way. As my best friend, he'd said all sorts of things to me after the crash. Words of wisdom, support, and love. I'd tuned it all out, but if there was one person I should have listened to, it was Aaron. Let's face it, I'm being forced to confront my emotional traumas. I have no choice but to move forward. How divine of an intervention was it that Aaron got traded to my team? That put this man back in my path, knowing he could offer me something I've been having a damn hard time accepting from others. We have a lot of catching up to do, I say, a tentative offer by me to repair our friendship. Yes, we do, he agrees with a smile. No time like the present to get started on that. He's right. No sense at all in stalling. In fact, I'll start with an admission that simply needs to be made. I'm really glad you're here.
Chapter 7. Nora. Pushing back into my office chair, I kick my booted feet up on my desk and stare at the ceiling. Tacker is due here at any moment for his first official counseling session, and I've been flip-flopping on how to handle him. I did indeed Google him after dinner with Raoul night before last. It was a wealth of information that explained exactly what was going on with him. First, I'd learned he is a hockey great, a veteran player who would be in the Hall of Fame sooner rather than later. I don't know much about hockey, but I read enough to know he was beyond revered in the league for his talent. There were a few articles out of the Phoenix paper that predicted bringing Tacker to the Vengeance was one of the greatest moves in sports history. Of course, I didn't understand the risk of such a move until I read a bit deeper on him. And that's when I found the source of his anguish. About 15 months ago, Tacker was piloting his own small craft from Dallas to Houston, taking his fiancée for her final dress fitting. They were to be married in 2 weeks. There was a malfunction in the equipment, and he was unable to determine where the horizon was on a very cloudy day, causing the plane to turn upside down due to spatial disorientation. He survived. His fiancée did not. The reports seemed to indicate he was out the rest of that hockey season, but they never specified the reason. It could have been physical issues, but it was vague. If I had to guess, he was probably just not able to return emotionally. Regardless, at the end of the season, he'd been traded to the Arizona Vengeance in the expansion draft, which was considered to be an incredibly risky pickup by the new team. They either got themselves a really hot, dynamic player or a damaged liability. I'm betting it was a little bit of both,
as his current stats seem to indicate he's one of the league's star players, at least from what I've read. Yet here he is, ordered into counseling to maintain his place on the team. The final piece of information I'd seen was from just a few weeks ago, when he'd driven his truck right into a concrete barrier while drunk. We're going to need to explore that. There's a subdued knock on my door at exactly 3 p.m. on the dot. Come in, I call, swinging my boots off my desk to stand. The door swings open, and in walks Tacker Hall. He's dressed the same as he was the other day, jeans, t-shirt, and tennis shoes. Clean-shaven, he holds a baseball cap in his hand. He gives a short nod of his head in greeting, and I smile in return. He looks like he's being led off to the guillotine or something. What's your anxiety level? I ask. Because we can take the horses out for a ride. I call it tucking from the saddle. It can help ease things.
Not much of a horse person,
he grumbles uneasily. I've got some gentle ones, I assure him. They'll just plod slowly along. Tacker twists the ball cap in his hands, but doesn't answer me. Instead, he glances around my office, but it's just a stall tactic. Not much to see in here. I read up on you, I say. He shifts toward me, eyes slightly narrowed. I know about the plane crash and your fiancé, the suspensions from the team, everything. My words are a means to get him to face his reality, that he has to begin somewhere. I've just given him an opening to see if he'll take it. It's a tough love type of opener, normally a path I would not take. But Tacker has made it clear he's not keen on my Pollyanna-type attitude. I've already figured he appreciates plain talk with no fluff. Tacker moves to one of the guest chairs. When he slowly sinks down into it, it's a silent statement that he doesn't want to ride today. I follow suit, dropping into my chair across the desk from him. When he finally talks, it's not what I'm expecting.
I Googled you too,
he says quietly.
Not much there.
My credentials are all on the website, I reply vaguely, although I don't think that's what he means. Tacker shakes his head, looking me dead in the eye.
Raoul said something horrible happened to you.
Ah, Raoul. That stinker. I nod, a genuine smile on my face, so he knows I'm not mad about Raoul's comment. I have nothing to hide, and my past has greatly benefited me in what I do today as a counselor. Would it make you feel better to know about it? I ask tentatively. I don't want to assume I know what he needs. He blinks in surprise, his chin jerking inward as he shakes his head.
No. I wasn't trying to be nosy or anything. I'm just not buying the whole happiness and hope stuff. That old dude.
Raoul, I interrupt. I'll introduce you to him soon.
Can't wait, he replies with a grimace. He was so charming.
I can't help but laugh. Raoul can be very charming, but he can be an ass when he wants to. He's the best man I know, I say firmly, making him aware I have a great allegiance to my friend. Tacker's expression seems dismissive, as if Raoul isn't something he wants to talk about. I'm surprised again when he blurts,
What happened to you?
He does want to know. He's convinced my happiness today is either a sham or that my pain wasn't all that difficult to handle. While I don't feel a need to defend myself or my history, I do think it can open a doorway to mutual trust with Tacker. I push out of my chair, then sweep my hand toward the door. Come on, let's go take a walk. Tacker stands too, but he seems unsure.
I don't need the walk. I'm good right here.
You might not, I say with a smile. But you asked about what happened to me, and while I have worked hard to overcome my traumas, it doesn't mean they don't still pinch at times. I like being outdoors. It makes me feel more peaceful. Tacker shakes his head, slightly panicked.
You don't have to tell me anything.
I move around my desk, put my hand on his lower back, and give him a gentle push toward the door. Yes, I do need to tell you. I lead Tacker past the small paddocks, the barn, and along the large pasture to a trail used for the horses. No one is scheduled to be riding out here at this time, so we'll have absolute privacy. The trail is mostly rocky terrain, over gentle hills. The ranch itself is over 100 acres of land, dotted with giant saguaros, mesquite, palo verdes, and ironwoods. We walk for a good half a mile, and I occupy the time by telling him the history of the ranch. I explain how I bought it out of foreclosure, then about my dream, to use the horses to reach people who are hiding behind walls. When I point out the flora and fauna of the Sonoran Desert, I'm pleased when he asks a few questions, his curiosity piqued. I want him relaxed. Keep your eyes peeled for rattlesnakes and scorpions, I say with a sly smile. Tacker actually jumps sideways as if I were pointing one out, shooting me a glare. I thought you said this walk was to help reduce anxiety. Laughing, I pat him on the arm, not breaking stride. I did. But I've got boots on. I'm not anxious at all. Your ankles are a little exposed with those tennis shoes, though. Another glare, and I toss my head back to laugh. I'm just teasing. Any creatures prone to bite aren't going to be on the trail. It's well used, and they're more afraid of you than you are of them. He seems unsure of my explanation, but his stride doesn't falter. I pick up an old stick laying across the trail, about 3 feet in length, and carry it with us. Just in case we come upon a lazy snake, I need to push out of the way. But I won't let Tacker know that. Okay, I finally say after taking a breath. You want to know about me? He doesn't reply, and I take that as his tacit agreement I should proceed forward. I was born in Albania, but my parents moved us to the Drenica Valley in central Kosovo when I was extremely young. I don't even remember Albania, really.
Your accent is more pronounced right now, he points out, and I nod. This is never easy to talk about.
Do you know anything about the war in Kosovo? I ask. Tacker lowers his head as he shakes it.
Can't say I do. Just what I've heard on the news here and there.
It doesn't really matter, I tell him. All you need to know is that I was 11 when war came to Drenica. My name was Nora Servadiku then, and my father and grandfather were part of a Kosovo-Albanian group of rebels fighting against the Serbs who controlled the region. I had an older sister, Besiana, who was 15, and a younger brother, Pieter, who was just 7. Besiana was only 4 years older than me, but she acted very much like my mother, who died giving birth to Pieter.
I'm sorry,
Tacker says awkwardly. With a smile, I press on. I'll never forget March 3rd. It was my birthday. Like I said, I was 11, and Besiana had promised to make me a shendetti, which was my favorite dessert.
But that didn't happen.
Tacker stops walking, turning to face me. No, that didn't happen. I look off into the distance, the sun starting to hang low over the foothills. When I shift to face Tacker, I just lay it out for him. Serb forces came into our village and went house to house, rounding up suspected members of the rebel group. My entire family was taken into the village square, along with other suspected rebel families. They separated the males from the females, then promptly opened fire on all the males.
Even, Tacker says,
but his voice fades quickly. Even my 7-year-old brother, Pieter.
Fuck,
he mutters, punching his hands down into his jeans. I'm heartened by the empathy I see on his face. If I had to guess, it's not an expression he's probably worn a lot lately. I give a slight cough to clear my throat, because it gets even worse. My sister and I were given to the soldiers. Besiana was repeatedly raped, often right in front of me, and by multiple men. I was made to cook and clean for them.
Christ,
Tacker growls. He starts to take a step toward me before faltering. I can tell he's not sure what type of support to offer, so I smile to excuse him from the burden. One night, a drunken soldier was getting ready to take his turn on Besiana. I just couldn't stand it anymore. I didn't care if I was putting myself at risk, so I screamed at him to leave her alone. And he only laughed. Then he taunted me, went so far as to take out his pistol, put it right in my hand, and dare me to shoot him if I wanted to stop it so bad. A low rumble emanates from Tacker's chest, and he looks sick to his stomach. And I couldn't, I admit, without dropping my gaze. It's a shame I've learned to own over the years of my healing. I was so scared that I'd miss, that I'd hit the mark, and another soldier would kill me. It didn't matter the reason. I just couldn't do it. I couldn't save Besiana.
You were 11.
Tacker bites out with a grimace.
You couldn't have done anything.
I know, I say softly, freely giving him another smile so he knows I'm okay. I turn to head back on the trail toward the paddocks. I've come to learn that. It was part of my healing and recovery from the massive guilt I suffered.
But you escaped,
he says, seemingly wanting to leave the bad parts of the story behind and push me forward in the narrative. I could tell him so many more awful details, but it's not necessary. So my smile turns brighter, because there was a beginning to my happy ending. A NATO worker smuggled me out of the camp one night. She was at the end of her tour and leaving for home soon. Her name was Helen Wayne. She was from here, in Phoenix. She adopted me, and that's when I became Nora Wayne.
And Besiana?
Tacker asks, stuttering only slightly in the pronunciation of her name. She took her own life, I say sadly, long before Helen got me out of there. We walk along in silence for a few moments. Finally, he almost whispers,
I don't even know what to say to that. In all the things I'd imagined, that didn't even come close.
I stop, reaching out to touch his forearm once again. Tacker comes to a halt, regarding me curiously. I didn't tell you that to try to one-up you on the trauma scale, or to prove you can survive something awful. I only told you so you could see it's possible to not only push past it, but also to flourish. He just stares. So I repeat, with emphasis, I have flourished, Tacker. And so can you, if you want to. He swallows hard, letting out a long breath. I've laid a lot on you today, I say, hearing the slight hint of apology in my tone. And it's taken up almost our entire hour. No charge for today, but if you can, come back tomorrow. We'll talk about MJ then, okay? He doesn't balk at my demand. Instead, Tacker nods.
Okay.
Chapter 8, Tacker. The breeze lifts MJ's blonde hair where it suspends, making it float across her face. She scrapes her fingers across her forehead, grabs the errant locks, and tucks them behind her ear. It's hopeless as the wind merely pulls them free to whip them around once again.
This was a stupid idea.
She laughs, turning her head to look at me. My hands are clenched tight on the pommel of the saddle, my legs gripping the sides of the horse in a death grip. Yeah, it was a stupid idea, but I wasn't about to say no to her. We were spending a romantic week at a resort in St. Croix, and MJ had it in her mind she wanted to ride horses on the beach at sunset. Sure, the sunset and beach part would be romantic, but the horses? Not so much. Being from Texas, MJ wasn't a stranger to horses, but I was from the concrete streets of Richmond, Virginia, and had never so much as touched a horse before. Not only was I out of my comfort zone riding the huge beast I was afraid would embarrassingly dump me on my ass into the wet sand at some point, but the winds were also so fierce coming off the water that my eyes were watering. Still, I know I'm dreaming, but I hold on to it. It's one of the rare dreams of MJ that I get that I actually treasure. A happy time where we were laughing and in love.
Who's that?
She asks, raising a finger to point down the beach. Turning my head, I squint my eyes against the wind to see a figure in the distance. I can't make out who it is, but it appears to be a woman. Weirdly, the wind doesn't seem to be touching her. Her dark brown hair lays calm along her shoulders. As our horses move closer to the woman, I can see she's wearing jeans and a flannel shirt, which is definitely not how one dresses on a Caribbean beach. And then I recognize her. Nora. I take in the odd way she's dressed, yet still appreciating how her curves fill out her Western wear in all the right places. The exquisitely refined facial features and cat eyes that stare knowingly at me. It makes me hot under the collar, and I slowly shift toward MJ, ready to explain how I know this woman and how there is no need for her to be jealous. MJ doesn't give me her attention, though. She just stares at Nora, head tilted slightly in curiosity, with a pleasant smile as she uses her hand to battle the froth of hair blowing around her face. When I dart a glance at Nora, she's still looking only at me, as if MJ doesn't exist. Her hand reaches out, beckoning me to get off the horse and come to her. Again, weirdly, the air around her is utterly calm and peaceful. Do I go to her? Do I leave MJ and this stupid romantic ride on the beach, which is one of my favorite recent memories that we would always laugh at later? Or do I get off this horse and go to Nora? The woman who is supposed to help me, what did she call it? Flourish? I wake up, jolting almost painfully out of the dream in a way that has me gasping for breath. My emotions are all over the place as I try to reconcile that it was just a dream, yet I still feel an unbelievable loss. I don't want to leave the beautiful memories of MJ behind, but I'm feeling an emptiness inside over not getting off that horse and going to Nora. God damn it. I mutter in frustration, now feeling a flush of guilt for even having Nora in the same dream as MJ. Suddenly, my entire body flushes as I start to feel awareness of other things. My body, my dick, to be exact. It's fucking hard as a rock, tenting the loose sheet over me. I have no clue if my erection exists right now because of MJ, Nora, or because I'm a man who hasn't gotten laid in a long damn time. Regardless, I don't want to be torn between which woman might encroach into my thoughts if I were to take myself in hand to get some relief. So I stubbornly ignore my hard-on and roll off my air mattress. A cold shower is the only thing in my immediate future. Few things touch me these days. When people wall themselves off, things just tend to bounce back from whence they came. But like Aaron showing up on my doorstep yesterday, this gesture by some of my teammates has a little cramp forming in the center of my chest. Aaron showed up at my apartment not long after I finished my cold but effective shower, demanding I grab some ice gear and get in his car. There's a home game tonight, which means that workouts will be light. Some guys will hit the gym, while others skate some drills. Nothing that will overtax, only get a player primed. I'm not back in the lineup, so it means a lot to be invited to an impromptu skate at one of the local ice rinks where we often practice. Dax, Bishop, Eric, and Legend are meeting us there. Coupled with me, it's the original first line of the Arizona Vengeance. Feeling some fucking nostalgia for sure, and not surprisingly, also excitement to get back on the ice. It's been 2 weeks since I've skated. We walk in, finding the guys already out there. They've apparently rented out the entire place, and it's quiet inside. Aaron and I give them a short wave before heading into the locker room to get dressed. It feels good, the ritual of putting on my gear, like slipping into a favorite pair of worn jeans or the softest t-shirt. When I step out onto the ice, there's not even a wobble or stutter. It feels like I'm a fish that's been out of water and I'm now getting my first gill full of oxygen-rich water. My first glide of blade to ice, I actually sigh in contentment. An overwhelming rush of gratitude overtakes me, and I swear if Dominic Carlson were here, I'd probably fucking hug him in thanks, which would cause a major freakout in my teammates for sure.
Wild!
Eric exclaims, and I watch as the other men congregate around Aaron. Like I said, everyone calls him that but me. While he was always the big partier and ladies' man on the Mustangs, he was always just my best friend, who often enjoyed a quiet evening playing board games with MJ and me.
Let's quit wasting time,
Bishop barks, then proclaims.
3-on-3, let's go.
I can't help but smile. When the season started, I was stunned Coach Perron had named me as captain of the team. While I had years of solid play under my belt, I'd never been much of an actual leader. Coming off a prior bad year due to the crash, it was even more shocking he'd hand that role over to me. That's all gone now. With my first suspension at the end of November, the title of captain was removed from me and given to Bishop, who had been co-captain along with Legend. I never begrudged that, since the guy deserved it. Still does, for that matter. Bishop runs us through drills, and the sweat starts to pour. There's a lot of bumping and joking going on, but there's a lot of work as well. The guys take it easy on me, since I'm still playing with a fractured left wrist. As such, my stick handling is tentative and slow, so they don't defend me too strictly. We skate for an hour, which is probably half an hour longer than the guys should, since there's a game tonight. I know they're pushing forward because they like seeing me back on the ice. More importantly, they can see I like it too. Finally, Bishop calls an end to the work, fun, and we move over to the bench we'd put our gear under. We grab water bottles and chug. Eric rips into a power bar as the dude is always eating.
How'd that feel?
Bishop asks as he wipes sweat off his forehead with the back of his arm. Fucking amazing, I answer truthfully, because he's the one who specifically called me out a few days ago about what an ass I've been and how I need to give back to my teammates. I decide I need to give him something. Thanks for this. Means a lot. He's not expecting it. Bishop actually flushes, his eyes darting to the side a moment before he recovers.
Yeah, not a problem. We're all anxious for that fracture to fully heal so you can get back in the lineup.
I'm anxious to get there too, I say. After this past hour on the ice, I'm ready to go there now. Fuck the broken wrist and cast.
You coming to the game tonight?
Dax asks. Until this moment, I hadn't thought about it. In the back of my mind, I'd just assumed I'd watch it from a bar or a restaurant, since I don't even own a TV. But I've got season tickets, which is something each player gets, so there's no reason I shouldn't go. I mean, sure, I'm still suffering under the crushing weight of guilt and self-recrimination, which doesn't make me an overly social guy, but these are my fucking guys. I'm back on the team and I need to support them. Yeah, I'll be there.
Want Reagan to pick you up? Dax asks. She's going, and she wouldn't mind swinging by to get you.
Oh, shit. I wasn't wanting to socialize or anything. I start proverbially backpedaling in my brain, trying to come up with a valid excuse to decline. The thought of potentially having to make small talk with someone for several hours is intolerable. Except, Reagan's not hard to talk to. Granted, I only met her a week ago at Billy's birthday party, but within a matter of moments, she actually had me blabbing a bit. She did this merely by sharing a huge secret with me that she and Dax had secretly married because she had a life-threatening illness and needed health insurance. To be told the information out of the blue by a complete stranger had caught me off guard. But there was something in her tone, perhaps a bit of uncertainty tinged with a little fear, that formed an almost instant connection between us. Much the same as I believe happened between Nora and me yesterday when she told me about what happened to her family. Christ, it's the worst thing I've ever heard about that happened to someone I know. It instantly made me realize she's not full of shit when it comes to her beliefs, and that perhaps there's more outside of this little bubble of my world than I had anticipated. And if I'm being honest, it humbled me, made me realize that despite how bad I have it and how painful my loss is, that I'm not unique in any way. That world is against me feeling I've been carrying heavy on my back lightened a bit because the pain is now shared. The world is out to fuck over a lot of people. Perhaps the epiphany I need to be searching for isn't in the why of it happening, but maybe in the where of the journey I'm on. If I'm being beyond honest, I'm not all that anxious about meeting Nora this afternoon, where she's going to expect me to talk about the crash and MJ dying. I nod at Dax, giving him a short but hopefully gracious smile. Yeah, if Reagan doesn't mind, I'll take that ride to the game. Chapter 9. Tacker. There's a note on the door to Nora's office that simply says, "In the barn." I trot down the steps, hang a right, and head toward the gray stable. It's gotten warm this afternoon, nearing 80, which is exactly one of the reasons I love living in a place like Arizona in February. Come July, though, I'll be hating it. The double barn doors are open on both sides, providing a view of the large pasture on the other end. There are a few people riding horses out there. I don't see Nora, so I start walking the length, glancing into the stalls as I move along. A horse sticks its head out, causing me to sidestep more toward the middle of the aisle. Finally, I find her in the last one on the left, along with the older man who jumped my ass the other day. The door is open, and the horse is tied to a lead latched into a hook in the wall. I step inside the stall, but I keep my distance. Nora's on one knee at the horse's front leg, lifting it to inspect the underside of the hoof. She tilts her head left and then right, peering closely at it. Shaking her head, she runs her hand over the lower part of the leg, her teeth dug down into her lower lip and consternation on her face. Finally, she releases the horse and pushes up as she says to the man,
"Your guess is as good as mine. Go ahead and call Dr. Jones. Let's have her come take a look."
The man nods, then lifts his chin toward me. Nora wheels around with a smile.
"Hey, Tacker. Glad you made it."
"Something wrong?" I ask, nodding at the horse.
"Yeah,"
she replies, worry in her tone.
"He's limping, but we're not seeing anything obvious, so Raul will get the vet out to take a look."
My gaze goes to the man, who stares stonily back.
"Oh, that's right,"
Nora exclaims, looking between us.
"You two haven't been formally introduced, even though you've seemingly declared yourselves as enemies."
My face flushes slightly at the accusation, particularly because Nora's tone is completely teasing. The man staring back doesn't give an inch.
"Raul, this is Tacker Hall,"
Nora continues brightly.
"And Tacker, this is my ranch manager and dear friend, Raul Vargas."
Neither of us moves.
"I demand you two shake hands,"
Nora says sweetly. I don't really have to do what she says, although I'd shake the dude's hand. Really, I don't have anything against him. He was looking out for Nora, and I get the concept. He, on the other hand, is employed by her and owes her loyalty. He has to do what she says. So I wait. Finally, he sighs and sticks a hand out, to which I grab and give a hearty shake. Laughing, Nora motions for me to leave the stall, which I do, and she follows.
"How are you feeling today?"
she asks. I turn to face her. "Pretty good. Actually skated with some teammates today, and it was good to be back on the ice."
"Awesome," she replies with a grin. "You feel up to a ride today while we talk, or would you like to maybe just help with some grooming?"
"Gotta be honest, Nora," I say with a sheepish smile. "I'm not a big fan of horses." Her head tilts, understanding smile in place.
"What's your fear?"
Falling and breaking my neck, getting bit, kicked. Take your pick." Her head tilts back as she laughs, her dark ponytail extending almost down to her butt. When her gaze returns to mine, she nods.
"That's fine. Horses aren't required, but they are available if they'll help to enhance therapy. While I'd love to get you over that fear, let's concentrate on why you're really here, shall we?"
I nod, grateful I'm not going to have to deal with the big beasts on this visit. If I'm going to be forced to relive the worst moment of my life, I want to do so from a position of safety and security.
"Do you like tea?"
she asks. Yeah, sure," I reply with a half shrug.
"Let's head up to the main house to sit in the living room,"
she says, pivoting to head out of the barn.
"It's more comfortable there."
I have to say, this was a good call. While her Spartan office was just as good a place to talk as any, something about seeing Nora kicking her boots off and curling her legs under her as she sits in a big leather chair with tea in hand is reassuring. I chose the leather couch that's extra wide and long, joking before I lower myself onto it. "Do I have to lie down on this?"
"Only if you want to,"
she quips. I choose one end, sit my ass down, and lean on the armrest, feet planted solidly on the braided rug below. Nora smiles pleasantly, blowing across her tea. Mine sits on the coffee table, untouched for now, as it's hot as hell. I'm at a loss as to where to begin, and she must sense it because she comes to my rescue.
"Tell me a little about MJ."
That's both easy and painful, but a lot more preferable than describing the crash. I smile, an immediate warmth rushing through me, and lower my eyes down to my hands as I talk. MJ was great. Her full name was Melody Jane, but everyone called her MJ. She was beautiful and sweet and really smart. She worked for a pretty big firm in Dallas as a CPA, but she was moving on up the ladder.
How did you meet?
Nora asks, her eyes bright with interest. It's cliche, but at a bar after a hockey game. She caught my eye because she was about the only female in the place not fawning all over the hockey players. She was always just a really confident woman, you know? And for whatever reason, that got my attention. Nora smiles and nods, blowing on her tea once more before taking a tentative sip. At any rate, we dated for almost 2 years before we got engaged, and, well, I'm sure you know if you read the news articles, we were just a couple of weeks away from getting married when... My words die in mid-formation, hanging heavy in the air. She doesn't push or pressure. Instead, she redirects me.
Tell me what you've been feeling these last few months. Paint a picture of your emotions for me.
That's easy enough. Really fucking simple, too. A lot of anger.
At who?
Me, I answer without hesitation. It's my fault she died.
Who else?
God. She nods, perhaps in true understanding. Maybe she was angry at God, too.
Who else?
People in general, I say tentatively.
Why?
For being alive. Happy. I actually jolt when the words are out of my mouth, but yeah, that's true. I just hadn't yet realized that I'm pissed at other people for being whole.
Who else?
She presses. My mind whirs, going through the mental list of things that offend me, but I feel like I've exhausted everything. I shake my head. I can't think of anything else. Nora seems to contemplate something, pausing to sit her teacup on the table beside her chair. She leans against the armrest, listing to the right, and clasps her hands together as she looks at me earnestly.
Why not the manufacturer of the plane?
Pardon?
If I understand what I read, the National Transportation Safety Board investigated the crash and you were absolved of any liability. The piece of equipment you relied on to keep the plane straight to the horizon was faulty. It's what caused you to crash.
Yes, but I stop, shaking my head. I mean, yeah, I get that, but I could...
No, stop, Tecker,
she says firmly, and my mouth snaps shut. Her words are slow and deliberate.
You were absolved of any culpability